Hi, this is Jeff Shapiro, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 2nd, 2025 issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. $10 billion and counting. Trump administration snaps up stakes in private firms. The Trump administration is spending billions of dollars on deals with ownership stakes in companies. The unusual practice shows no sign of slowing. The Trump administration is snapping up ownership shares of private companies that it deems essential to national security. It is an unusual new strategy that has already committed more than $10 billion in taxpayer funds and shows little sign of slowing. The government's growing portfolio of corporate ownership involves minority stakes or the option to take them in the future in at least 9 companies involved in steel, minerals, nuclear energy, and semiconductors. A New York Times analysis found the deals were all struck in the past 6 months, with the bulk made in October and November. The effort appears mostly driven by national security concerns, particularly a desire for the government to prop up strategic industries and lessen America's reliance on foreign countries like China for key resources. Some officials are hopeful the equity stakes will generate a windfall for taxpayers, but the likelihood of that is unclear. Many of the companies are facing financial headwinds, and some could take years to become profitable. The unusual government intervention into the private market is fueling some concerns, including the opacity of the process, the potential for favoritism, corruption, and market distortions, along with the possible loss of taxpayer funds should the investments fail. Aaron Bartnick, a fellow at Columbia University and a former Biden White House official, said that there were serious questions about whether the government role in private industry would address national security vulnerabilities and deliver a return on taxpayer dollars. In the absence of a clearly articulated strategy, he said, the concern was that this could just devolve to arbitrary deals that favor friends or disfavor foes. Kush Desai, a White House spokesman, defended the administration's approach. If business as usual policies worked, America would not be relying on foreign countries for critical minerals, semiconductors, or other products that are key for our national and economic security, he said in a statement. The administration's targeted equity stakes ensure that taxpayers get a good bargain and that the ball meaningfully moves forward to encourage further investment by the private sector. Prior administrations have tried to speed the development of sectors like semiconductors and clean energy with grants, loans, tariffs, and other policies. But taking equity stakes in companies is incredibly rare. During the 2008 financial crisis, the government took over shares in companies that were faltering or whose collapse posed broader financial risks, including General Motors and Chrysler, along with the giant insurer, AIG. The Trump administration has taken a more aggressive and opportunistic tack. Trump officials have proposed establishing new price floors for minerals to help American firms remain competitive in the face of cheap Chinese imports. They have also discussed taking a cut of certain export revenues, in addition to building a growing portfolio of equity ownership. The approach contradicts traditional Republican thinking about the power of the free market to identify winners and losers. But officials in both parties have become more supportive of industrial policy and government intervention in recent years. That shift has been brought about by China's dominance of strategic industries, and accelerated by its move to clamp down on exports of minerals needed to make planes, semiconductors, robots, and cars this year as part of a trade clash with Washington. Daniel Kishi, a policy advisor at American Compass, a conservative think tank that supports industrial policy, said that concerns about intervening in markets rested on a flawed premise. Markets have already been significantly distorted by Chinese subsidies and Beijing's efforts to monopolize global industries, he said, necessitating U.S. government intervention. We need an industrial policy of our own to combat the predation of our trading partners, Mr. Kishi said. Like past administrations, Trump officials have continued taking stakes in companies through the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, which finances private sector projects around the world. Over the past 5 years, the Development Corporation has invested in dozens of international funds and companies. But the Trump administration has begun using other agencies to take equity stakes as well. Many of the minerals investments are being made through the Defense Department, which has tried to develop sources of rare earths outside of China. Some deals involve the Defense Department's Office of Strategic Capital, which was set up in 2022 and received additional funding through the Trump-backed tax and spending law passed this year to invest in critical minerals, shipbuilding, and other strategic sectors. The Energy Department has leveraged loan programs created in the Biden administration to take equity in mineral companies. The Commerce Department has also used its control of a Biden-era semiconductor fund and investments from foreign countries to begin building a portfolio. The administration's first significant investment took place in June when it acquired a golden share in U.S. Steel in exchange for allowing Japan's Nippon Steel to buy the iconic firm. Administration officials demanded a non-financial stake that would give them veto power over certain company decisions like moving factories offshore. When U.S. Steel planned to close a facility in Granite City, Illinois, earlier this year, the government used its influence to intervene. In July, the Defense Department agreed to take a $400 million stake in MP Materials, which is a mining company that has struggled to turn profits amid tough price pressures from China. Excuse me. A month later, the Commerce Department became the largest shareholder of Intel, the beleaguered U.S. chip giant. A public filing from the Office of Government Ethics shows that shortly after that agreement was made, President Trump personally purchased between $1 and $5 million of Intel's corporate debt. The government's equity deals gained speed as China's export curbs intensified, putting America's access to critical minerals and magnets at risk. And in October and November, the government made a spat of investments with companies specializing in rare earths. In October, the Commerce Department also gained the option to take an 8% stake in Westinghouse, the nuclear power company. The Commerce Department will help facilitate the construction of nuclear reactors across the United States. If Westinghouse's valuation reaches $30 billion, the government can require it to carry out an initial public offering with the right to purchase a fifth of the new public company. Trump officials have speculated about taking stakes in more firms, in industries including mining, semiconductors, technology, and defense. Not all companies have welcomed government investment. Some firms have been reluctant to meet with Trump officials out of fear that the government would pressure them to hand over parts of their company. According to industry executives, Intel agreed to do its equity deal with the government after Mr. Trump called for its chief executive to be fired over ties to China. Officials and analysts have also questioned how much due diligence that the Trump administration is performing. While the Biden administration took many months to evaluate targets for grants and loans and was often criticized for moving slowly, the Trump administration appears to have arranged several of its equity stakes in a matter of weeks. William Rensch, a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is a Washington think tank, said Biden officials had been slow and meticulous in selecting targets, while Ms. Trump seemed to be investing by whim. You know, he meets with somebody, he likes them, and so, well, let's do a deal, said Mr. Wrench, a former Commerce Department official. You don't get the sense with Trump that there's a strategy to it. You get a sense that it's a series of tactics. Darrell West, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a Washington think tank, who has studied the deals, agreed that in a number of these cases, there seems to be almost no serious review. They don't seem well thought out, Mr. West said, adding that some of the investments involved high-risk areas. There's no guarantee the government's going to make money, so they're really putting taxpayer money at risk. But some analysts have praised the Trump administration's sense of urgency, saying that the Biden administration had done extensive research on America's dependence on Chinese rare earths, but done little to change it. After China responded to Mr. Trump's high tariffs by clamping down on its exports of those minerals in April, U.S. officials began calling companies to ask about their capacities and searching for pots of money to deploy. Private companies, too, began pitching their services to the government, sometimes relying on old friends or former business associates to arrange meetings. At the Defense Department, a critical minerals task force was set up in the spring with roughly 40 officials and a 90-day deadline to identify new rare earth resources, one former official said. Officials had estimated that it would take more than $3 billion in investment to reshore supply chains for rare earth magnets, a critical component for automakers and defense companies. The Defense Department turned to MP Materials, a company that makes those magnets, and had bought a struggling rare earths mine in California. In July, the company announced that the federal government would invest $400 million in exchange for a 15% stake, including warrants, which give the government the right to make future stock purchases. Some Pentagon officials expect the deal to be profitable, but analysts have expressed skepticism. Others have pointed out that the long timeline for this plan and other minerals projects, like a mine in Alaska being developed by Trilogy Metals, in which the Defense Department said last month it would take a 10% stake. You have an entire subset of the U.S. economy that's almost running dry, and if the relief comes in 10 years, that's not necessarily going to have any impact on short-term company needs, said Emily Benson, the head of strategy at Minerva Technology Futures, which is a consultancy. In early November, the government announced its latest equity deal with Vulcan Elements, a North Carolina-based startup making rare earth magnets. The company offered the government equity and warrants in return for $50 million from the Commerce Department and $620 million from the Defense Department. Vulcan Elements plans to expand its capacity to 10,000 metric tons in the next few years, up from 10 tons currently. The company has received investment from several venture funds, including 1789 Capital, where the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., is a partner. In an interview, John Maislin, the chief executive of Vulcan Elements, said the company had received no political favoritism and that the partnership would help reduce a dependency on China that could prevent the United States from making key goods like cars, phones, and robots. We're making sure that we don't have to ask China permission on whether or not we're allowed to build or buy defense applications or data centers from our AI race, Mr. Maislin said. This truly is about making sure that we have the redundancy and the resiliency in the United States to control our destiny. This needs a whole of industry and a whole of government approach working together to solve this problem, he added. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Appeals court says Alina Habba is unlawful U.S. attorney. The judges wrote that the Trump administration appeared to have become frustrated by legal and political barriers that have prevented its preferred U.S. attorneys from leading federal prosecutors' offices. A federal appeals court said on Monday that Elena Haba had been serving unlawfully as the U.S. attorney in New Jersey, dealing a blow to the Trump administration and most likely setting up a showdown at the Supreme Court. Ms. Haba is one of a number of U.S. attorneys whom the Trump administration has sought to keep in power through a series of unusual maneuvers, even though she was neither confirmed by the Senate nor appointed by district trial court judges, the two traditional pathways. Defendants in New Jersey had challenged her authority as U.S. attorney, leading to Monday's decision. In its ruling, the three-judge panel, which is based in Philadelphia, affirmed an earlier ruling by a federal district court judge. The court said that the government's tactics had violated the law as written and concluded that overall, the Trump administration appeared to have become frustrated by legal and political barriers to placing its favored U.S. attorneys in charge. The maneuvers undertaken to keep Ms. Haba in charge exemplified the difficulties that the administration had faced, the judges wrote, and yet, they said, the citizens of New Jersey and the loyal employees in the U.S. Attorney's Office deserve some clarity and stability. It was not immediately clear how the ruling would affect legal proceedings in the New Jersey federal courts or whether Ms. Haba will continue to lead the office in the near future. The courts had already been operating in a kind of limbo, given her uncertain status. Certain types of criminal cases were slowed, and some grand jury proceedings were actually halted. The Justice Department and a spokeswoman for Ms. Haba did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The lawyers who challenged Ms. Haba's authority, ABD Loyal, Gerald Grobatin and Norm Eisen, said in a statement that the ruling showed that President Trump cannot usurp longstanding statutory and constitutional processes to insert whomever he wants in these positions. They vowed to continue their challenges to President Trump's unlawful appointments of purported U.S. attorneys. The case involving Ms. Haba may be the first of its kind to reach the Supreme Court, though it is possible that a similar case involving the U.S. attorney in Virginia, Lindsey Halligan, could be expedited by virtue of being entangled with criminal cases against President Trump's enemies. Last week, a federal judge found that Ms. Halligan, too, had been unlawfully appointed by the Trump administration. The Justice Department has vowed to appeal. Ms. Haba, who's 41, had represented Mr. Trump in several civil cases and played a public role in his 2024 presidential campaign. But she had no experience in criminal law before the president named her in March to a 120-day interim term as New Jersey's top federal prosecutor. Mr. Trump nominated her to take on the role permanently, but her appointment was doomed by opposition from the state's two Democratic senators, Cory Booker and Andy Kim. In July, judges in the District of New Jersey declined to extend Ms. Haba's term and instead tapped a veteran prosecutor, Desiree Leigh Grace, to lead the office. That led Attorney General Pam Bondi to disparage the judges, fire Ms. Grace, and elevate Ms. Haba to the role of acting U.S. attorney through a complicated series of maneuvers that were at the heart of the appeal. But on Monday, the three judges, Felipe Restrepo, D. Brooke Smith, and D. Michael Fisher, said that each of those maneuvers had violated the complex set of laws that governs vacancies at the top of federal agencies. When Ms. Grace was fired, the Trump administration designated Ms. Haba to fill her role as first assistant, the highest-ranking position in the office, given that there was no U.S. attorney, and argued that doing so meant that Ms. Haba was effectively acting U.S. attorney. For good measure, the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, also appointed Ms. Haba a special attorney with jurisdiction over New Jersey. But the judges wrote that the automatic elevation of the first assistant occurred only at the actual time of the vacancy and that neither the president nor anyone else could interfere with that process. As for the special attorney appointment, they said, it was plainly prohibited by law. The Monday decision affirms a ruling by Matthew Braun, the chief judge of the Middle District of Pennsylvania, who concluded in August that Ms. Hobb had been serving as New Jersey's U.S. attorney without legal authority since July 1st. Lawyers with the Department of Justice, which had appealed Judge Brand's decision to the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, had argued that the president's power was broad and gave the executive branch substantial authority to decide who was executing the criminal laws of the United States. Lawyers for Cesar Humberto Pina, a defendant indicted in New Jersey on fraud charges on July 10th, had countered that Ms. Hobb's installation as the state's top prosecutor violated a law known as the Federal Vacancies Reform Act. The lawyers, Mr. Lowell, Mr. Crovatin, and Mr. Eisen, said in court papers that Mr. Trump had pursued a shell game to keep her in power. Relying on a chimera of at least seven different statutes, the government has at various times described Ms. Hobb as interim U.S. attorney, acting U.S. attorney, first assistant U.S. attorney, and special attorney, they wrote. But she doesn't have the authority to lead the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of New Jersey under any of those titles. Monday's ruling was the second time in a week that a federal appeals court panel has dealt a heavy blow to Mr. Trump and Ms. Hobb. On Wednesday, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, based in Atlanta, upheld nearly $1 million in penalties meted out by a lower court judge against the president and Ms. Hobb for filing frivolous lawsuits against more than two dozen of his enemies, including Hillary Clinton, James Comey, the former FBI director, and the Democratic National Committee. Johnson and Trump try to avoid an upset House loss in Tennessee. Speaker Mike Johnson put the president on speakerphone during a Monday stop in the state, underscoring the unusual amount of national attention on a House special election. The crowd milling around the sleek multi-million-dollar barn full of gleaming vintage cars was already a snapshot of the Republican elite in Tennessee. There were donors, state representatives, five members of Congress, the governor, and the candidate for the state's House special election on Tuesday, Matt Van Epps. Then Speaker Mike Johnson, who flew in from Washington early Monday, called President Trump and put his phone on speaker. "The whole world is watching Tennessee right now, and they're watching your district," Mr. Trump said, his voice crackling over the phone. "The election," he added, "has got to show that the Republican Party is stronger than it's ever been." The phone call, coupled with the convergence of political heavyweights, underscored just how much Republicans appear rattled by the Tuesday election for what would normally be a safe conservative seat in Tennessee's 7th Congressional District. It is the final special election of 2025, and as Mr. Johnson told reporters, "We think what will happen here will be a bellwether for the midterms next year." Mr. Van Epps is running against State Representative Afton Benn, a Nashville Democrat who has energized many in her party despite a political record perceived by some as too liberal for Tennessee. "I thought Tennessee was deep red. How did that happen?" Mr. Johnson said of Ms. Benn, calling her a dangerous far leftist that would be a rubber stamp for Representative Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader, and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, a favorite progressive target for Republicans, among others. The district, which cuts through part of Nashville and stretches between the borders with Alabama and Kentucky, was left vacant after Representative Mark Green stepped down for a private sector job this year. Much of the rally was not about Mr. Van Epps, an Army veteran and former state commissioner, but was instead focused on what a Republican victory on Tuesday would mean for the party's razor-thin majority in the House and the country's future. An Emerson College survey last week showed Mr. Van Epps beating Ms. Benn by only 2 percentage points, which is an uncomfortable margin in a district carefully drawn to favor a Republican candidate. Mr. Trump won the area by more than 20 points last year. "We are out front right now, but we want to finish this fight," Mr. Van Epps said. Mr. Van Epps' former primary opponents, three congressional representatives and both U.S. senators from the state, all lined up to cast the race as a chance to prove that the state's Republican bona fides and reject the liberal attack of National Democrats. They pointed to Ms. Benz's support for transgender Tennesseans, her enthusiastic trailing of immigration agents in Nashville this year in protest of their presence, and comments she made in 2020 that were critical of the police. Such a candidate, Senator Marsha Blackburn told the crowd, is not the type of person who should be representing Tennesseans, and you are not going to let that happen. Representative Tim Burchett, who drove in from Knoxville, was more blunt. Folks, we are one flu season away from losing the majority, he told the crowd, adding, this is our chance to tell America that we've had enough of this far-left craziness and everything that this woman represents. He was among those who pointed to one clip in which Ms. Benn professed a hatred for Nashville and its downtown tourist scene of pedal taverns, country music, and bachelorettes as a sign that she is out of touch with the district. How the heck can she elect a person like, can you elect a person like that? Mr. Trump asked. Ms. Benn, speaking to supporters on Monday, downplayed the criticism. National Republicans are panicking because the story of the South is changing, and they can see it happening right here, she said. Ms. Benn, for her part, spent the weekend canvassing with Democrats across the district and held a virtual rally with Ms. Ocasio-Cortez and former Vice President Al Gore, the last Tennessee Democrat to rise to the highest levels of national politics. Mr. Gore told the hundreds of supporters gathered on the Zoom call that Tennessee has proven again and again that we can answer the call of democracy, and that great cause of American democracy is calling us once again tomorrow. Ms. Ocasio-Cortez said that in a district so favored by Republicans, it takes a very special kind of person with a very special kind of guts to run as a Democrat. Hegseth ordered a lethal attack, but not the killing of survivors, officials say. Amid talk of war crimes, the details and precise sequence of a September 2nd attack on a boat in the Caribbean are facing intensifying scrutiny. The Trump administration on Monday defended the legality of a September 2nd attack on a boat in the Caribbean Sea as calls grew in Congress to examine whether a follow-up missile strike that killed survivors amounted to a crime. The lethal attack was the first in President Trump's legally disputed campaign of killing people suspected of smuggling drugs at sea as if they were combatants in a war. It has started coming under intense bipartisan scrutiny in recent days, amid questions about the decision to kill the initial survivors and what orders were issued by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. At the White House on Monday, Carolyn Leavitt, the press secretary, read a statement that said Mr. Hegseth had authorized the Special Operations Commander overseeing the attack, Admiral Frank M. Bradley, to conduct these kinetic strikes. She said that Admiral Bradley had worked well within his authority and the law, directing the engagement to ensure that the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated. According to five U.S. officials who spoke separately and on the condition of anonymity to discuss its sensitive matter that is under investigation, Mr. Hegseth, ahead of the September 2nd attack, ordered a strike that would kill the people on the boat and destroy the vessel and its purported cargo of drugs. But each official said that Mr. Hegseth's directive did not specifically address what should happen if a first missile turned out not to fully accomplish all of those things. And the official said his order was not a response to surveillance footage showing that at least two people on the boat survived the first blast. You're continuing to listen to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Admiral Bradley ordered the initial missile strike and then several follow-up strikes that killed the initial survivors and sank the disabled boat. And as that operation unfolded, they said Mr. Hegseth did not give any further orders to him. The officials clarified the sequence of events amid the political and legal uproar that has followed a report in the Washington Post last week. It said that Admiral Bradley ordered the second strike to fulfill a directive by Mr. Hegseth to kill everyone. The reaction has included questions about whether Mr. Hegseth specifically ordered an execution of shipwrecked sailors in violation of the laws of war. Speaking to reporters on Sunday night, Mr. Trump said that Mr. Hegseth had denied ordering a second strike to kill two people who were wounded but still alive after the first one, saying Pete said he did not order the death of those two men. Mr. Trump also sought to distance himself from the follow-up strike, saying he wouldn't have wanted that, not a second strike, although he said the first one was fine. He defended his broader policy of having the military use lethal force against people suspected of smuggling drugs. Starting with the September 2nd attack, his administration has said it has carried out 21 such strikes in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific, killing 83 people. Mr. Hegseth called the Post reporting fabricated and inflammatory. And as we said from the beginning and in every statement, these highly effective strikes are specifically intended to be lethal kinetic strikes, he wrote on social media. In another social media statement on Monday, Mr. Hegseth said that he stood by Admiral Bradley and what he called the Admiral's combat decisions in the strike. Admiral Mitch Bradley is an American hero, a true professional, and has my 100% support, he wrote. I stand by him and the combat decisions that he has made on the September 2nd mission and all others since. Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi and chairman of the Armed Services Committee, said on Monday that he had spoken with Mr. Hegseth and General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, about the strikes and that his committee would conduct a congressional investigation into the matter. The defense secretary also spoke with Representative Mike Rogers of Alabama, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, according to a U.S. official. In interviews on Monday, two U.S. officials, both of whom were supportive of the administration's boat strikes, described a meeting before the attack at which Mr. Hegseth had briefed Special Operations Forces commanders on his executive order to engage the boat with legal force. That written order, they said, did not address what should happen if people survived the first strike. Several people familiar with the congressional effort said that lawmakers had asked to see a copy of this order and that the administration refused to turn it over. The two officials also said that Mr. Hegseth made no oral directive at the meeting that went beyond the written order. The Post article did not provide context on when Mr. Hegseth gave what its sources described as a spoken order to kill everyone. The two officials questioned whether the surviving people were Admiral Bradley's intended target in the second strike, as opposed to the purported drugs in the disabled vessel. They argued that the purported cargo remained a threat and a lawful military target because another cartel-associated boat might have come to retrieve it. One of the officials said that the U.S. military intercepted radio communications from one of the survivors to what the officials said were narco traffickers. If so, members of Congress could request those communications as part of its oversight investigation. The suggestion that Mr. Hegseth, Admiral Bradley, or both targeted shipwreck survivors have been galvanizing because that would apparently be a war crime, even if one accepts the Trump administration's disputed argument for why its boat attacks have been lawful. Generally, a military cannot deliberately attack civilians, even suspected criminals, who do not pose an imminent threat. The administration has argued that the strikes are nevertheless lawful because Mr. Trump has, quote-unquote, determined that the United States is in a formal armed conflict with drug cartels, even though Congress has not declared any such war. Mr. Trump has also, quote-unquote, determined that the crews of the boats are combatants. A still secret memo by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel accepts Mr. Trump's determinations, according to people who have read it, adding that it concluded that suspected shipments of drugs are lawful military targets to prevent cartels from using them to finance their war efforts. A broad range of legal experts reject that analysis. But even if this were an armed conflict, it is a war crime to kill enemies who are out of the fight. That category includes enemy fighters who have surrendered or are otherwise defenseless and pose no threat. Members of the armed forces must refuse to comply with clearly illegal orders to commit law of war violations, the Pentagon's law of war manual says, adding, for example, orders to fire upon the shipwreck would be clearly illegal. It also says that it is prohibited to conduct hostilities on the basis that there shall be no survivors, or to threaten the adversary with the denial of quarter, which means refusing to spare the life of an enemy who has surrendered or who is unable to fight. Jeffrey Korn, who is the Army's senior advisor for law of war issues, said that he believed that the entire attack was illegal because he rejects the administration's argument that the situation can be legitimately treated as an armed conflict. But even if it were one, he said, an order specifically to finish off shipwreck survivors, whether or not Admiral Bradley believed he was carrying out Mr. Eckstedt's instructions, would be unambiguously criminal. Still, he said, if Admiral Bradley's order was instead to finish destroying the vessel, even if people were clinging to it, that would be more complicated. In a real naval armed conflict, he said, it is lawful to fire on a partly disabled enemy warship that is continuing to maneuver or fire its guns, even if there are wounded sailors aboard or shipwrecked sailors clinging to it. But if a warship signals that it is out of the fight by ceasing firing and lowering its colors, he said, then it becomes illegal to keep firing upon it. The problem with all that, he said, is that the speedboat was not a warship with guns to stop firing and colors to lower. This is the consequence of treating something that is not really an armed conflict as an armed conflict, he said. The speedboat could not signal that it was out of the fight because it was not really fighting to begin with. Professor Korn, who now teaches military law at Texas Tech University, said that as lawmakers seek answers, they could look into whether the missile used in the second strike was configured as an anti-personnel device, one that is designed to produce lots of shrapnel, or was instead configured to cause maximal damage to a large object. Beaten and starved, Israeli hostage recounts 2 years of captivity. Segev Kalfon said that he endured physical abuse and mind games during 738 days in the hands of Hamas. Now, he asks why it took so long for Israel to bring him home. A Hamas commander presented 6 Israeli hostages huddled in a tunnel in Gaza with a choice. Pick 3 to be executed and 3 to be shot in the leg, one of the captives, Segev Kalfon, recalled. He pointed a Kalashnikov rifle to my head and asked, "Should you be first?" Mr. Kalfon said he persuaded the burly commander to spare him. "But then he wanted to kill my friend," he added. For hours, the Palestinian militant toyed with them before sending them all back to their cell. After surviving 2 years in captivity, Mr. Kalfon was finally released on October 13th as part of a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, in which the last 20 living hostages were freed in exchange for 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Mr. Kalfon was among the first to speak openly about his experience. He was abducted on October 7, 2023, when Palestinian militants rampaged through southern Israel, killing about 1,200 people and abducting roughly 250 others. Like many hostages, Mr. Calfone's account of his 738 days in captivity included numerous examples of physical and mental abuse. The captors broke his teeth, starved him, and pressured him to convert to Islam. He blames Israeli officials for drawing out his captivity, believing that those in power could have acted sooner to hasten his release. After a far-right Israeli minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, bragged about worsening the conditions for Palestinians in Israeli jails, Mr. Calfone said that he and other hostages were beaten. Mr. Calfone, who's now 27, spoke to the New York Times as he sat outside a hotel turned into a rehabilitation center near Tel Aviv. "Speaking out," he said, "is therapeutic." Many of the details that he recounted align with what some of the other hostages held with him told Israeli media. Several of them corroborated episodes like the mind games and the beatings that they endured as revenge for Mr. Ben-Gvir's words. Hamas did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Mr. Calfone described it being deprived of food. During one stretch, he had to make a small can of beans last for 2 days. At times, standing became a struggle. The last 20 living hostages appeared to be in better condition than the frail captives released earlier in the war. Mr. Calfone said that Hamas had given them more food in the prelude to their release. A doctor who treated 10 of those returned hostages, Dr. Noya Shiloh of Sheba Medical Center, said that they told her that Hamas had given them more food in their final days of captivity. "The longer people were in captivity, the deeper the damage," Dr. Shiloh said. "They went through horrible abuse," she added, noting that some of the physical and mental consequences could take years to surface. Other captives who spoke after they were released also said that they were held in suffocating underground makeshift cells, beaten, and given barely enough food to survive. Some said that they were kept in solitude for long periods. Two said that they were victims of sexual violence. Guy Gilboa Dalal, who was freed on the same day as Mr. Calfone, told the Israeli channel N12 that on one occasion, after he had showered and was still naked, his captor forcibly touched his body. Mr. Calfone, the second year of captivity, was worse. Desperation drove him to devise a dangerous escape plan, he said. Then he heard his mother, Galit Calfone, speaking on a radio the hostages managed to tune to Israeli broadcast. "She said she misses me," he recalled. He abandoned the idea of escaping. Hearing her voice, he said, gave him an ocean of hope that he would return. On the day of October 7th attack, Mr. Calfone said he fled the Nova Music Festival under a hail of rocket fire from Gaza, sprinting through furrowed fields, bullets whistling overhead. He fell straight in the hands of a group of gunmen in white pickup trucks. Blindfolded and bound, he repeated the Shema, a Jewish prayer, in his head as his captors beat him ferociously. "I got to the point where I didn't feel the blows," he said. Before his capture, Mr. Calfone, from Dimona in southern Israel, worked in his father's bakery and as a fiber optic cable installer. He had recently begun a career as a financial trader. After being driven into Gaza, he said he was stripped down to his underwear and questioned as one militant held a box cutter to his throat. He was soon joined by two more captives, Yosef Chaim Ohana and Maxim Herkin. For the next 8 months, the three men were held in apartments in central Gaza, hustled from one hideout to another under Israeli bombardment, Mr. Calfone said. He was constantly petrified, fearing that his captors could kill him at any moment, while Israel's rain of missiles were also terrifying, he said. "All I could think of was how to survive another day," he said. You are continuing to listen to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In that first week, when he asked to use a bathroom, he said a gunman tripped him every step of the way and whipped him repeatedly. A few days later, an Israeli airstrike blew away the top three floors of the building that the hostages were in. The kidnappers threw them clothes and flip-flops to put on and then led them onto the street to the next location. In total, the three men would stay in about a half dozen locations, some for as little as a few days and some for a few months. They shared a used toothbrush. Mice scuttled around sometimes, Mr. Kalfon recalled. He said they were forbidden from talking to each other, save for a few snatched whispers. Mr. Kalfon said that they were silent, like one tree next to another. Gunmen would come and go, often ferrying weapons. One played around with live grenades to scare them, Mr. Kalfon said. On many days, he said all they had to eat was a quarter of a tomato and a shared small bowl of rice. Despite the widespread food shortages that would grip the Palestinian residents of Gaza because of Israeli restrictions, the hostages' captors appeared well-fed, Mr. Kalfon said. At times, they snacked on large bags of cookies and mixed nuts right in front of them, he recalled. Mr. Kalfon grew thinner as the months passed. In the summer of last year, the three hostages were in a building in Nusrat in central Gaza, where fierce fighting erupted outside. The kidnappers locked them into a small bathroom, Mr. Kalfon said. They embraced and said their goodbyes. They later learned that Israeli commandos had rescued four other hostages in a deadly raid nearby. Days later, their captors took the hostages down into the tunnels where they would spend the next 16 months. The Israelis were led to a tiny space where they joined three other hostages, Bar Cooperstein, Elkanah Babat, and Ohad Ben-Ami, Mr. Kalfon said. Their captors kept watch from about 300 yards away. The six hostages were given rice with worms, moldy pita, and sometimes nothing at all. Their captors kept saying that if the people of Gaza above us were hungry, we will also go hungry, Mr. Kalfon said. Mr. Kalfon said that they were kept in darkness much of the time, but that they were able to talk. The six would tell the same stories again and again, how they were kidnapped and about their lives before the attack. They spoke about food, relaying their family's recipes, as they shriveled like ghosts, Mr. Kalfon said. After Mr. Ben-Gvir boasted of toughening the conditions of Palestinian security prisoners, Mr. Kalfon said he and the others were beaten by their guards as revenge. They said it was because of Ben-Gvir, Mr. Kalfon said. Mr. Herkin and Mr. Cooperstein similarly described the abuse set off by the Israeli minister's remarks. In response, Mr. Ben-Gvir said that he was proud of his prison policies and that the news media had adopted Hamas's narrative. During the ceasefire this past January, their captors summoned the six men for the execution game. The hostages refused to choose which three would be killed, so the kidnappers drew lots. Mr. Ben-Ami and Mr. Ohana corroborated the account. A militant, known as Hajj, Mr. Kalfon said, appeared to be in charge of the group. After his release, Mr. Kalfon said he learned Hajj's identity when Israeli security officials showed him photographs and told him his name was Bayan Abu Nar, the Hamas battalion commander in Nusrat. Mr. Kalfon also confirmed his identity from a photograph shown to him by the New York Times. Mr. Abu Nar, who Mr. Kalfon described as a tall, bearded, and frightening character, told the hostages that they had been saved from execution because Islam rejected killing prisoners. He pressured the hostages to convert to Islam and brought them a radio to listen to recitations of the Quran, Mr. Kalfon said. Mr. Kalfon said that he and the other hostages managed to fashion a makeshift antenna to pick up sporadic broadcasts of Israel's army radio, including the interview with Mr. Kalfon's mother. After almost a year in the tunnel, Mr. Abu Nar split the group and took Mr. Kalfon and Mr. Ohana to a different tunnel. Mr. Kalfon, who by then knew more Arabic than his captors realized, said that he eavesdropped on many of Mr. Abu Nahr's calls. Hamas members were cautious and seemed to speak in code, he said. They typed secret messages on a computer and saved them to a thumb drive. One day, Mr. Calpone recalled, an explosion shook the tunnel. Television images showed the destruction from an airstrike, and Mr. Abu Nahr received a call informing him that his wife and several family members had been killed. I was scared to death of what he might do to me, Mr. Calpone said, but the commander just bowed in prayer. Mr. Ohana was moved again, and Mr. Calpone remained alone with Mr. Abu Nahr for his final 10 weeks in captivity. Mr. Calpone said that they shared a room and had long conversations during which the militant admitted that had Hamas known the consequences of the October 7th attack, it would not have carried it out. In the days leading to his release, he was moved to another tunnel where he met other hostages. They were given clean clothes and brought above ground to a greenhouse to await the handover. A Hamas operative played one last mind game. You alone will be sent back to the tunnel, Mr. Calpone recalled the operative saying. I almost had a stroke on the spot, Mr. Calpone said. Less than an hour later, he was handed over to the Red Cross and driven to the Israeli border. Mr. Calpone said he now appreciates every little thing in life, even drinking a glass of clean water. While he knows that many in Israel hope for his return, he said that he's angry that the government took 2 years to secure his freedom. Why did it take so long, he asked. Why did they let us go through all of this? Imperial Israel in the New Middle East by Roger Cohen. Beaufort Castle, atop a towering cliff that rises from the Litani River in southern Lebanon, is a 900-year-old Crusader fortification offering a magnificent panorama. These days, it may also be a place from which to view a killing. The sky was cloudless blue on a late September afternoon as the hum of an Israeli drone disturbed the beguiling beauty of the surrounding olive groves and vineyards. Steadily, it grew closer. Then, with a screeching whistle, the drone fired a missile that turned a white car on the highway hundreds of feet below the stone castle into a ball of fire. The explosion reverberated in the valley. Other cars careened to a helter-skelter halt. About a half hour later, a New York Times photographer, David Guttenfelder, and I reached the incinerated carcass of the car. The driver's seat was blown to oblivion. Two distraught young men, dressed in black, picked up small pieces of charred flesh, one by one. They dropped them into plastic bags to be buried the next day. So goes the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, reached a year ago on Thursday. Almost daily Israeli strikes against Hezbollah, including the killing this week in Beirut of one of the militant group's top commanders, punctuate a fraying peace. Lebanon exists in a gray zone between war and peace, which could also be the fate of Gaza as Hamas resists disarming and Israel strikes selected targets. In effect, the war that spilled into Lebanon after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel has slowed but has never stopped. The Israelis say they can't leave unless Hezbollah disarms. And Hezbollah says, how can we disarm as long as the Israelis don't? Nawaf Salam, the Lebanese prime minister, said in an interview, Hezbollah knows things have changed in the region, but are still trying to resist. A morass of mistrust has now led to a dangerous escalation, and the Trump administration's target for Hezbollah to disarm completely by the end of the year looks implausible. Across the region, the United States is pressing to transform the Middle East by new means. Democracy is not part of President Trump's lexicon. Prosperity, not the ballot box, is put forward as the new panacea. But a journey of several weeks to Lebanon, Israel and Turkey suggest that for now, renewed war is likelier than spreading peace. The situation in Lebanon offers a compelling example of a new Middle East, where Israel's reach is near ubiquitous. The Iran-led axis of resistance, of which Hezbollah has been a central part, is a shadow of its former self. Iran, battered by Israel in a brief June war, is weaker, Syria, after the fall of the Assad regime last year, is no longer a friend of Tehran, nor is it the pipeline of Iranian arms to Hezbollah that it once was. The region is adapting to what Atgha Abdullah, a prominent political scientist in the United Arab Emirates, called an imperial Israel, a country that will kill enemies anywhere, from Lebanon to Syria, Gaza to Iran, Yemen to Qatar. Preemptive Israeli strikes are the new norm. But given such dominance, the United States will have to decide what constraints, if any, it's going to impose on Israel in the interest of furthering peace in the region. One way to achieve this may be strengthening the militaries of other regional players like Saudi Arabia or Turkey, which Mr. Trump seems intent on doing. For Hezbollah, diminished but defiant, the adjustment has been severe. It has not responded militarily to Israel's attacks on Lebanon, even since they intensified after the Gaza ceasefire last month. Israel accuses Hezbollah, which has deep roots in Lebanon's large Shia community, of seeking to rebuild its combat capacities. Tom Barak, the U.S. ambassador to Turkey and special envoy to Lebanon and Syria, told me that if Israel senses any threat, they're going to respond at any time, anywhere. When the Israelis find these guys, they just take them out, so you have two or three a week that are whacked, he said of the strikes against Hezbollah. That was the fate of Hassan Abdel Karim Sharour, later identified by Hezbollah in his white car beneath Buford Castle on September 20th. The Israeli military said it had eliminated a Hezbollah terrorist. What Jamaica wants after deadly hurricane? Visit us, the island said. Tourism accounts for nearly a third of Jamaica's economy, so officials are rushing to reopen dozens of hotels in time to salvage the vital winter travel season. With power still out 9 days after Hurricane Melissa swept through western Jamaica, Kelani Kerr stood in the dark at the stifling hot souvenir shop in Negril where she works, waving a fan at her sole customer. She tried to guesstimate how dependent Negril, a beach town on Jamaica's far west coast, is on tourism. From a scale of 1 to 10? 10, she said. Or maybe 100, because that's what we use here to survive. Ms. Kerr is one of the more than half a million Jamaicans whose job depends directly or indirectly on tourism in the Caribbean country that in October was battered by its first Category 5 hurricane. The storm killed at least 45 people, damaged about 150,000 buildings and homes, and crippled the tourism industry, which the Israel Island Nation relies on for nearly a third of its economy. With dozens of hotels wrecked by the storm's extraordinarily fierce winds and deluges of water, Jamaican authorities are rushing to reopen tens of thousands of hotel rooms in time for the crucial winter travel season. Tourism authorities announced that the country would be back in business for visitors by December 15th, which the government considers the start of the season, an ambitious goal that many in hotels said that they were not going to be able to meet. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 1st, 2025 issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Jeff Shapiro. Thank you for listening.